Charles Stockard was a very interesting experimenter, and he knew the literature of the experiments that had been done in experimental embryology before him, so that he would relate to us. The lectures began at 7 o'clock in the morning before his other classes were, and we learned about the anomalies. So that he, for instance, he had a little sea trout that he would immerse in a magnesium sulfate solution and then let them go on to develop into trout, and these trout would be born with one eye, the cyclopia. And in that way, he explained how malformed infants are born with just a single eye. You've heard about the cyclops in mythology. Actually, there are such specimens of babies born. They are miscarriages, of course, born dead. Stockard subsequently became the head of the Rockefeller Foundation. Curiously, this course was the first course of that kind that was given in for any group in New York, and it was due to several of us who had drawn up actually what we missed in our education and what we felt we ought to get. We based it on our basic medical education, and we felt we ought to have a similar education in ophthalmology. We couldn't get very many of the residents from the hospitals to take it. There were only probably a half a dozen of us in that class. But the following year, the professors at Columbia, Cornell, Bellevue, and New York Hospital, well, the New York Hospital wasn't built at that time yet, the New York University, they came down and saw to it that they got the same course. Out of that grew a research institute in New York. There hadn't been any research institute before that. I still prize the notes that I took in that class. Having finished my residencies and my training, I was requested by Dr. May, who was head at Mount Sinai, to come into his office to join him in practice. And he arranged for me to be a junior assistant at the hospital. But about that time, my parents were, of course, anxious for me to return to Pittsburgh. Dr. Robert Zucksmith, who was a dentist and was quite a good friend of our family, visited New York City, and he and his wife, Flossie, and they took me out to lunch, and they convinced me that I ought to return to Pittsburgh, and I ought to heed my parents' advice. So I came back to Pittsburgh, and I moved into office. Gave me one of the rooms in his office, and I worked there for a year and a half, and the rooms, it really crowded him because he gave me the room that he had for his assistant. He treated me wonderfully, charged me very little rent. I'm just getting started, but he felt that's what he wanted to do.
Where was his office?
His office was in the Jenkins Arcade Building. My practice fortunately grew rapidly, and I needed more space. And the Jenkins Arcade in that in those days was fully rented. But a skin doctor on the same floor had died, and he had offices with Dr. Milton Goldsmith and one other man. So his space became available to me. While I was in that office, before I had moved into this second office, There was a Dr. Wild practicing in Pittsburgh, and Nathan J. Wild. He was an interesting character. He had an excellent education, both in Germany and in Switzerland, and was a very good eye doctor. But he hadn't kept up with the times from the standpoint of surgery. He and Dr. Krebs used to operate together, and he came to see me one time, and said, "Why don't you come and watch us operate?" So this was about a year after I had started up in Pittsburgh, and or a year and a half. And I said, "All right, I'll be glad to." They operated on Thursday afternoon. They would start about 1 o'clock and operate into the night. Both one man used to assist the other. But then Wild turned to me between operations and said, "How would you do this next case?" And I saw the patient. And I said, "Well, you're just making fun of me. You're an experienced man, and you're asking me, just a beginner, how I would do it." He said, "No, I'm not joking." He said, "How did you learn to do it in New York?" I told him. He said, "Go ahead and do it." And I hesitated. I said, "This is your private patient." He said, "Never mind, you go ahead and do it." And I did that operation. The next week he gave me another operation to do. I didn't have much surgery in those days. I was just a young practitioner. And within 3 months, he had me do all his surgery. I was a ghost surgeon. His patients either knew or didn't know that I was...
Did he pay you for these patients?
No, I did them all for free. I might tell you an interesting experience. One day, I did an operation on a man who was a very wealthy man, extremely wealthy man, in fact, was considered to be a millionaire, we were used to, after we finished with our surgery, go down to Klein's, who were then in the 7th Avenue Hotel. They had a restaurant, and we would have dinner. As we're walking out of the hospital, he pulls out a check, and he shows me a check for a large sum of money. He says, "This isn't all. This is a down payment on the operation." And then he reaches in his other pocket, he pulls out a stogie, you know what a stogie was? And he hands it to me. He says, "This is all you'll get." And I said, "Well, I'm satisfied." We went on down to the Klein's, and we had dinner, and I put down 15 cents as a tip. The dinner in those days was 65 cents or something like that. And he said, "Take that nickel back." He said, "I'm only putting down the dime." And he was outspoken that way. I didn't take the nickel back. I think it was all right. One day he said to me, he says, "Thorpe, why don't you develop an eccentricity?" He said, "I have an eccentricity." I said, "What for?" He says, "So people will get to know you. They'll talk about your eccentricity and your name will get around." I said, "Ned, I might be able to do it for a week, but then I'll forget about it. It's just not my nature." But you see, he was a man that used various approaches for developing his practice in his early days.
Well, then, when you were in private practice...
By myself.
From then on...
I was right along from private practice. About a year after that, his mother died, and he almost had a mental breakdown, and he wanted to sell out to me his whole practice. He had an enormous practice for $1,000, and I said, "Man, I would never do it." So in the year 1926, we joined together as partners against the advice of most of my friends. Curiously enough, I took the I was awarded the major percentage. I think my percentage was about 45%, and Dr. Weil's practice was probably 35%, was about 30%. And then we had a man by the name of Dr. Isaac Davis. He was our junior man, and he had the difference. After about a year and a half, Weil and I broke up. He was pretty rough with the patients, and he would swear at the secretaries, and we had a difference about a case, and he grew upset about it, and we broke up. And we had a very large suite of offices, and we just separated the offices by a wall, which gave him part of the waiting room and gave me the rest of the waiting room. So we were next door to one another for quite a long while. He didn't talk with me. In the meantime, the new Montefiore Hospital opened up in Pittsburgh in 1929. The year before that, Weil, and who had been chief of the hospital, and I was an associate, and I had been running the clinics from about 1925 on at the location of the old hospital, and Jeanette Bachman was one of my clinical assistants. Dorothy Block was one of my clinical assistants. She's a widow now. One of the doctors of West Bend, his sister was one of my clinical assistants. And Alice Grafner was one of my clinical assistants. I worked hard, but I would much spend several mornings a week just working in the clinic. I'm just reminiscing, you know, so you'll pardon my wandering. When we moved into the new hospital in 1929, Weil and I met, and for a division of the services, and I said, "You're going to work in the clinic too, aren't you?" He said, "Are you?" I said, "Sure, I'll be working in the clinic 3 mornings a week." Well, he says, "I'm not." And with that, within a week, he just dropped it. And I appointed a number of the younger men to work, and I had already been teaching the younger men since about 1925. They used to come to my home. I'd lecture to them, and I took my cue from Dr. Wheeler, who was a great teacher, and from Dr. Knapp, and I felt that I would like to teach young men. So when the hospital opened in August of 1929, we had space, and we had space for lectures, and Dr. Pachtman came to work with me, and he had been studying with me while he was in general practice. Dr. Rubin came to work with me. Later on, a Dr. Goldberg came to work with me, and others, Dr. Kuntz, quite a few men, some Gentile boys too, and I made the boys toe the mark. They had to attend the clinic regularly. I watched their notes so that I would be sure that they would really learn the work. I'll never forget Dr. Rubin, who worked with me in 1930 and 31. I was married in December of 1930, and I operated a case for Dr. Landon at the West Bend Hospital. It was quite a long case. It took us 3 hours to do the plastic operation, and the patient had an eye burn. And Dr. Rubin assisted me, and I went on my honeymoon, and Dr. Rubin continued to take care of the case. And I got back from our honeymoon in Cuba, And I said to Dr. Landon, what will I charge for this case? And I figured he'd say $300 because we worked about 3 hours on the case, and Dr. Rubin had to make daily visits, and he would have to be paid up. And said, well, this is a compensation case only. It only charged $100. Well, if an older man said that to me, that was all right. That's the way we were in those days.
Could you tell me about what kind of health and medical care was available when you were a child in Europe, and what was available when you first came to America?
We had an excellent doctor in Liebau by the name of Eschenbach, E-S-C-H-E-N-B-A-C-H. He was a German doctor who had, he was originally from Liebau, but he went to Germany to study. He came back and practiced in Liebau. He was an older man when we went to see him as children. And I think possibly that may have influenced me being interested in medicine too.
When you came to America, what kind of health services were there?
When we came to America, there was a Dr. M.A. Goodstone, who was in general practice and was recommended to us, and he took care of the family for many years.
Well, you were growing up here. What did you do for fun and recreation? What type of recreation did you have?
We used to play baseball. We play a game called cat and dog, which you don't hear of anymore. It was a piece of wood with a tapered end that you would lean over a small stone or another piece of wood, and then you would strike it with a cut-off broom handle, and then hit it, and someone out in the field had to catch it. They caught it, while you were out, and you had to go out.
When you were a little older, what did you do for recreation?
When I was older, in high school, we used to have dances, and in my early life, I also went with my dad to many lectures. There used to be some of the Russian Jewish socialists used to come over to Pittsburgh, and my dad took me to the lectures of these people. They would usually lecture in Yiddish. And I remember also the famous Chicago attorney came here. Clarence Darrow. And my dad took me to the lecture of Clarence Darrow. And I'll never forget the remark he made in one of his later lectures. He said, last night I got on the train to come to Pittsburgh, and he said there were a lot of people going the other way. You know what he meant? It's a reflection on life. Darrow had been the man who had defended three men who were accused of throwing a bomb at a governor in the West, and Pettibone, and these three labor leaders were not convicted. They were set free.
When you were in college, what did you do for recreation?
I used to go to the many lectures with Dad, and we used to go to concerts. In college, most of my work in college was really very little recreation. There was some recreation because I was working after school. In my freshman year in engineering school, I joined the cap and gown club. And Judge Wolk, he was in law school. He was a senior in law school. And he was the leading man, and I was in the chorus. That was one of my early attempts at doing chorus dancing. And I joined the cap and gown club, I think, the following year, too. And then after that, I was in medical school, and I didn't partake of the cap and gown club anymore.
Tell me about your courtship. Where did you meet your wife and so forth?
Why, I was a member of the Mercantile Club, at which owned the old Kaufman home on Beacon Street. And we used to have wonderful Sunday evening parties. We had a lot of parties there. But on Sunday evenings, we had music, and we'd invite the girls, or those that we knew, or that some of the boys would bring to the club. And we'd meet on the third floor, which had a very large dancing area, and it was quite improved. And I think the Mercantile Club opened about 1925, about there. And we had a wonderful time. And Edith graduated high school, and
Edith, what was Edith's name?
Nehaus. She was from McKeesport. And the chap who was studying for the rabbinate brought her up, and I only saw her back walking up to the stairs, and I decided I wanted to meet her, and I've forgotten this man's name. He afterwards was a rabbi in the East somewhere, the Reformed rabbi. And he introduced me, and I guess it was a year after Edith had finished high school, and she was home on vacation from college. She'd been to Westchester College. And I met her then, but the next day I had her to lunch. And then she went away to college, when she got back, we dated, and we married in December of 1930. She had, in the meantime, been teaching, and she was very nice. She would come in from the Keysport, and we would meet at her uncle's house, or her aunt's, one aunt's house, or another aunt's house.
Did you have any children?
No, we had no children of our own. We adopted two children.
What are their names?
Linda is the older one, and the younger one is Harvey Jr.
Where are they now?
Linda lives in Los Angeles, and she has two children, and lovely children. One is 15, and the other one will be, I guess, one's 15 and a half. The other one will be 14 next month.
What are their names?
Lee, Michael is the boy, and Lori is the girl.
And the name of your other child?
Harvey Jr. has no children. He just married in the spring.
Where did you live when you were married?
We first lived at the Shenley Hotel, and then we took a furnished apartment on Center Avenue, across the way from the Ambassador apartments. I can't tell you the name of this apartment.
Haddon Hall?
Something like that. And I said to Edith, you have to learn to drive. I think you ought to learn. Well, that's where she learned to drive. And fortunately, she's an excellent driver. After we lived there for a while, our own home, my parents' home, was vacant because my father had developed a very bad heart, and they had to move to a one-level apartment. So they moved to the roof garden apartments, and there was a depression on, if you remember, 1929, 1930, 31. And we decided to take the house over, and we remodeled it. And then
where was the house?
The house was a corner forward and Tilbury, right catty-cornered from the rear of the where the high school later was built.
When did you move here?
We moved here in, we bought this house just before Pearl Harbor. And there were tenants in here. They didn't vacate the place until they had rented the place. And this belonged to an estate. They vacated it in 1st of May. And we had to then refurnish do the place over completely. And everything, all the wood was dark. And we didn't move in until November.
Had you been living in the house on at Forward until then?
Yeah, we lived from 1931 until 1942.